Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm Duncan MacLeod. I'm joined today by someone who's no stranger to Tech Central's podcast, and that's Andrew Fraser. Andrew has kindly agreed to help us unpack the latest developments in South Africa's digital terrestrial television nightmare, which just gets more bizarre with every passing week, it seems. Andrew's followed the debacle closer than almost anyone else in the country, and he's become a real expert on the subject. So thanks for chatting to Tech Central today, Andrew.
Oh, thanks a lot.
So the latest development is, of course, the article which appeared on News 24 late last week, I think it was on Friday, which said that MultiChoice made a questionable payment, News 24's words, to the Gupta-owned ANN7 of 25 million rand. The insinuation in the article is that the payments, including an increased annual payment to ANN7 of 141 million rand, up from 50 million rand, may have ultimately helped ensure that the communications minister, Faith Mutambi, pushed through a decision against encryption in digital television. Andrew, these are pretty sensational allegations. What, in your view, should we make of them?
I think that they're pretty sensational, and it does answer a question that I think we all had at the time when Faith Mutambi actually announced that there would be no encryption on the set-top box that were going to be financed by government. I, for one, was pretty surprised, not because I think it's a bad idea. I think it was the correct thing to do, but because it was a little bit out of character. The ANC had a policy that the set-top boxes would be encrypted. Up until that stage, the noises from government were heading in that direction, which in my mind was the wrong direction, but they seemed to be heading in that direction. And then there was this kind of policy statement from her that that's the way it would be. And these kind of inference into what, how do we call them? Inferences by News 24, maybe that's the reason that we saw that massive kind of 180-degree shift in policy. But, you know, is it proof that she was bribed or that she was under the influence of the Guptas? I don't think there's proof. It's basically just more information that helps to build a picture, as Pravin says. We have to join the dots.
Yeah. Well, the key question is here is, as you've suggested, is that why did Faith Mutambi go against the policy position of her own party? You and I agree that encryption is a bad idea for free-to-air television, but Mutambi actually thumbed her nose at the ANC. Trying to figure out what happened here is trying to answer that question at the end of the day, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, let's not beat about the bush here. I mean, that if we're expecting a corporation like NASPAS or MultiChoice Africa or DSTV, whatever you want to call it, if you're expecting them not to try and protect their monopoly, then you're living in a fairy tale. I mean, that they're going to do that. They're going to take any measures, hopefully legal measures, any measures that they can do to protect their monopoly. And that's obviously going to include lobbying government as much as possible. So I'm a little concerned about the News 24 article making a big deal about some of the policy recommendations that were sent from MultiChoice to Faith Mutambi, because That's what we can see. But I mean, it's a standard kind of situation, is that, that businesses do lobby government. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a fact. And MultiChoice is one of the biggest broadcasters in the country. So you'd expect that the minister who's in charge of broadcasting would have some kind of relationship with the broadcaster. So I think we must be careful about making too much of the fact that that is a smoking gun, that mm-hmm. that MultiChoice was trying to influence the minister. I think that happens all the time. And I think, and if we were to go and find some ETV leaks, I'm fairly sure that we'll find that ETV was doing exactly the same thing at the same time.
I was just about to say, I'm sure all these companies are lobbying the relevant yeah. minister at all times.
So I think that, that we must be a little bit wary about saying that this is a smoking gun of corruption, and it shows that, that, that something was happening. There does seem to be something a little bit odd about the amount that MultiChoice is paying ANN7. It does seem a very large payment for a station that doesn't perform very well. And I think,
although MultiChoice has said that what they pay ANN7 is a fraction of what they pay the other news 24-hour news channels that are, on at the DSTV platform.
But yeah, but 99% is also a fraction.
Sure.
So you know, it's all about the language.
Sure. But certainly what we do know from the Gupta Leaks emails is that annual payment was increased from 50 million rand to 141 million rand according to the fourth revision to the channel supply deal, and that there was a 25 million rand payment made up front, which, as I understand it, MultiChoice is saying that that was needed to improve the quality of ANN7. And of course, we all know the quality of ANN7, certainly when they launched, was very poor. There were spelling errors on the screen. There were it looked like amateur hour. So certainly MultiChoice must have been concerned about the quality of the channel.
Well, it's still not exactly professional hour.
No. So, it has improved.
It has improved. I mean, but also, you know, if you do something for long enough, you can't get worse at it. I'm a little concerned about that. It's like the reason... And this is rumors and innuendo that I've heard within the industry, is that ANN7, the reason that MultiChoice was keen to get ANN7 onto their channel as a news channel is that they were threatened by the success of ENCA. Mm-hmm. ENCA was a runaway success in terms of a news channel. It had garnered, in terms of local news, I think before ANN7 came on, it had 85% of the local news coverage, because the only other channel was SABC News.
Which only launched later, right?
No, SABC News was before that.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah, I think SABC News was on long before ANN7 was considered.
No, I meant it came after ENCA.
I'm not sure of the exact timing. I think SABC News has been there since 2007. So, I mean, it's not a new channel.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought it was more recent than that.
No, it's been there a while. It's just never been very good. And understand, with the political interference of the SABC, the credibility of the SABC news channels was pretty poor, particularly to a DSTV audience. So I think that there were rumors that ENCA was just so popular, and that they were gaining an ability to negotiate their license fee,
right?
Which MultiChoice wasn't too happy about, because effectively ETV is a competitor. You know,
and of course they've been warring it with each other over encryption.
Yeah, so I think that there was a bit of negativity about that, and MultiChoice were keen to get another news, a local news channel,
for leverage.
For leverage, yeah, in terms of negotiation, in order to mitigate the audience that ENCA had, and also their strength of negotiating in terms of licensing. And reading, and I don't think that's ended. I think that the relationship between MultiChoice and ETV regarding ENCA is still, what's the word?
Fraught.
Fraught is probably, yeah, I think it's strained. They have a commercial relationship. Obviously, there's benefits to both parties, but they are competitors in some ways. Mm. And just reading, I was reading eMedia's results for this year, the 2017 results, and there's a interesting little note there about the licensing, where they said that their license expired at the end of 2016, and after some negotiation, they put in a temporary license in January. So after it had expired, they put in a temporary license, and it seems they've now signed a 5-year license agreement. So obviously those negotiations were not run-of-the-mill. You know, the license actually expired before they put a temporary license in place. And I think that we have to take that into account as well. It's like one of the reasons that DStv wants ANN7 is to be a competitor to ENCA. I don't think that DStv is keen to fund the Gupta propaganda machine. I think that arguing that they're doing that is probably not true. I think the content on ANN7, which is largely propaganda, is out of their control. And the pressure that they're under now is that they're in a lose-lose at the moment, is that they can't come out of this looking good. Either they cancel ANN7.
Which they have said they may very well do next year when the contract runs its course.
Yeah. Well, that's the easy way out, you know. Mm. And then they'll cite commercial things, saying that, you know, that the quality wasn't good enough and that they weren't satisfied with the way that ANN7 actually put the stuff out there. But the other side of it is that they keep the channel on, and then they have to deal with the outrage of their subscribers who don't want to pay towards it.
But they're already facing a reputational risk here, aren't they? I mean, if you look on social media, the amount of outrage already on Twitter, for example, about the deal with ANN7, and I've seen post after post after post on Twitter of people saying, that's it, I'm cancelling my DStv subscription, I've had enough, I'm not funding the Guptas, I'm out. And of course, people have options now. They can go to Netflix or other fiber-based options. How much of a threat do you think ANN7 is actually to MultiChoice reputationally and commercially?
I think reputationally it's a big problem. I mean, reputationally is that, I mean, they weren't everybody's favorite company to start with, let's face it. I mean, I think that has to do a lot to do with the outrage. You know, it's like when your insurance company does something wrong, you know, you feel justified in disliking them for so long.
It's a grudge purchase.
Yeah, you don't really want to do it. I mean, I feel, you know, that 800 odd rand that you're paying towards towards something, it's a grudge, you know. You don't enjoy it. You think it's overpriced, and then you find out they did something that's morally or ethically questionable. It gives you a right to be outraged, and the Twitter outrage machine will grind on, and people will throw their hands up. But in terms of commercial impact to MultiChoice, I don't really see it making such a massive difference. Everybody talks a lot on Twitter, but
they want to watch their rugby as well.
When they want to watch their rugby, they don't really have a choice, and they'll still. They'll still pay their subscriptions. But I think the reputational thing is that, you know, nobody wants their name in the headlines. They don't want people talking about them in a negative light. They don't want to be tied to the Guptas, which is effectively what's happening now. Is that, so the narrative now is that MultiChoice is enabling the Guptas to bribe a minister. You know, we don't really know if that's true. We don't know. I think that possibly MultiChoice was wrong to even put the station on, but I'm not sure that they did anything illegal.
Yeah. I mean, some people have argued that MultiChoice should not pull the plug on a news channel out of principle. But, you know, is that right?
The kind of free speech.
Free speech angle to it.
There's no free speech protection for a commercial entity to be forced to carry a station. It's a commercial decision. They're not banning ANN7 from broadcasting. They're just not giving them a platform.
Yeah, there's no automatic entitlement for the owners of ANN7, now nominally Mzwanele Manyi, to have DStv carry them on their platform, right?
Yeah, I've seen actually some journalists arguing that, you know, that they shouldn't be taken off the air, and they should be, you know, because it's a free speech issue. I think it's conflating two completely different issues. There's nothing stopping ANN7 and Mr. Manyi from broadcasting over the internet or negotiating with Platco to put their channel on, OpenView HD. Or to speak to Starset and put it onto Starset. You know, there are options. They could as I say, I think they already have a live streaming channel.
Mm.
There's no impact on their free speech. The impact is a commercial one.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess those other platforms won't pay them 141 million rand a year for
that. Well, that's really the point, that their station isn't commercially viable as an advertising funded operation, unlike ENCA. I mean, so I'm guessing they probably get a similar amount from DSTV, but they can raise significantly more through advertising because they've got the viewers.
Mm, indeed. Now, the Democratic Alliance has called for a parliamentary probe into the multi-choice ANN7 deal. And I see Parliament saying this morning that they're going to consider the DA's request seriously. I wrote a column on Tech Central yesterday saying NSPAS should appoint an independent third party to probe the allegations. MultiChoice, of course, has professed its innocence through all of this. What do you think needs to happen for MultiChoice to be able to clear its name, given all the mud that's been slung around in the last week?
As a reputational advisor. I think they've got a bit of a problem. Is that some of the information that needs to be investigated is commercially sensitive.
Yeah.
It's stuff that is that's secret and necessarily secret. It's not that they're trying to hide something, but it's confidential business. You know, it shouldn't be in the public eye. And that becomes difficult for them to defend themselves, because they may well feel that they've got a good argument, but actually the information is just not visible and can't be made visible because of commercial reasons. I'm not sure that a parliamentary inquiry is actually going to be able to get any more information than we can get out of media reports and Gupta leaks, to be honest with you. The process of parliamentary inquiry is to ask questions, and they can only give the information that they're legally allowed to give. You know, things that are in confidential agreements can't be disclosed even in Parliament. So I think that probably you would need to have some kind of forensic investigator who is mandated to do it, who can maintain that confidentiality and can produce a report. The question is, how do you find one of those that's credible? You know, did you go to KPMG? You know, and that's the issue. You know, do you go to, SNG auditors who've also been fingered? It's hard to find somebody that's credible to do that kind of stuff. You need to possibly get hold of a judge that people will trust to do an inquiry. It's a difficult situation. So I'm not really sure how they're going to get out of this. It is a little bit scary, because in the case of MultiChoice, that none of their communications was with the Guptas directly, apart from the contracting stuff in terms of the ANN7, which is what you'd expect. I mean, they were negotiating a contract. But the information that's come out of the Gupta leaks now has been via Faith Mutambi, not from MultiChoice to the Guptas, but via Faith Mutambi.
Faith Mutambi was forwarding emails
from them to the Guptas. And that probably is because she wasn't able to really make a decision herself, and she needed somebody to guide her, and I think the Guptas were quite happy to step up and do the guiding.
And that's the scandal here.
Yeah, that is the scandal. I mean, the scandal that we have here is the fact that secret information is being passed on or confidential government information is being passed on to a commercial entity, which is, you know, the Guptas or Sahara or ANN7, etc., which puts them in a position to commercially benefit without necessarily being the best in that area.
Is there a way for MultiChoice to clear its name, if it needs to, by not going through a process where they appoint a forensics auditor or someone similar? Can they afford to just let this lie?
Yeah, I don't know. It's noisy. And you know, kudos to News24, which is part of the same stable, for putting the story out there. But Yeah, I'd say I don't think so. I think that they're going to have to do something. Yeah. They're going to have to make some kind of attempt to mitigate the damage. How long it'll last, I don't know. I think, you know, these storms tend to blow over. So if they can ride it out for a month or two and make some movements, you know, the silly season's coming now, so there'll probably be a bit of a quiet period. If they can ride it out, I'm guessing it'll just be business as usual for them next year.
People tend to forget about these things because there's so much else coming out of these Gupta leaks and all the other corruption that's going on in South Africa. It's overwhelming.
I think one thing that this leak has done is it's pointed at another issue, which is a little bit separate, which is the MultiChoice's agreements with the SABC.
Yes.
For their archival footage, etc., and their station, and the agreements that they concluded with then CEO or COO Claudio Montenegro. Which again all seem pretty much legal, but morally a little bit questionable. Is that they've used their power to force another party to suit their agenda. So they've dangled a carrot and said to the SABC, you know, we'll help you out, we'll broadcast this stuff, but we're going to stop you from putting it on encrypted channels if you want to sell it to somebody else.
It's a very odd clause to include in a channel supply agreement, right?
It shows what their motivation is, you know, that they were protecting their monopoly.
So government policy wasn't going their way, so they tried to use a commercial contract with the public broadcaster to...
They used the strength they had, which is their commercial might. They're powerful in terms of they have assets at their disposal, and they used them. The agreement with the SABC is... I know there's been a lot of noise about it being that unfair and it weighted towards MultiChoice and that Cloudy gave away the crown jewels. But to be honest with you, SABC was doing nothing with those assets. They lacked the resources to digitize them correctly. There's kind of 1-inch tapes in a basement in SABC that are just degrading. So what MultiChoice offered really had some real benefits in terms of archiving that footage, getting it on air, allowing people to actually see all these old programs and the stuff that was produced over the 30 years or 40 years that the SABC had been producing television. So there were some real advantages for the SABC, and I think it's not really correct to point fingers and say, you know, that the MultiChoice ripped off the SABC. You know, they only paid them 500 million Rand, or I can't remember the exact amount. But MultiChoice aren't stupid. They also slipped in a couple of interesting clauses, which helped their argument in terms of non-encrypted decoders.
Which wasn't illegal, but could have been morally.
I think, you know, what they're saying, business ethics is a contradiction in terms. I think that they were on the edge ethically by including that. And also, I mean, at the same time as the breakdown when the Faith changed the policy, when she put out the new policy, the SABC were one of the parties that said, we don't want encryption. And that was probably driven by
pressure from
MultiChoice, because they were concluding this deal for the archival footage. So it's not clear, you know, it's not, there's no black and white here. I think there's some very dark shades of gray in the whole process. I don't think that MultiChoice necessarily acted 100% ethically. I'm not convinced that they broke any laws. I think they've got lawyers on retainer who can tell them where that line is. And if this ever went to court and they were charged with anything, I think they'd be able to get it off.
Yeah.
But I think that they should still answer, because there's some ethical breaches, I think, that they did.
Which has a reputational impact, because this information is now out there and people are analyzing it. And and people are asking questions. Has multi-choice crossed a line?
I think, yeah, as I say, it's easy to, people make a lot of noise about multi-choice. I think they're more upset about how much they pay them every month than they are about things that they've done unethically, to be 100% honest.
Sure.
So I think it's a storm. And, you know, we just have outrage fatigue. You know, there'll be something else to be upset about next week.
Yeah, for sure. Let's spend a bit of time talking about the encryption debate, because that seems to be the basis of everything that's happened in this space in the last 10 years, sitting with this digital migration project. There's a war that's been going on for years between MultiChoice on one side and ETV and some set-top box manufacturers on the other. ETV has long argued that encryption and conditional access is necessary to stop the free-to-air sector from becoming ghettoized, ETV's word. Do they have an argument that encryption is necessary so that they can secure better content?
No, I don't think they do. And I think the Constitutional Court or the Supreme Court of Appeal basically told them that in the last judgment.
I think it was the Concord, yeah.
Yeah, it was the Concord, yeah. Mm. No, I don't think they've got any argument. You know, the fact is that, yes, premium content needs to be secured. It can't be easily copied, but that doesn't mean encryption. That just means that it needs to be copy protected, and that copy protection exists in multiple ways within the decoder itself. So first of all, in terms of the analog output, in terms of macro vision, and in terms of the HDMI output or digital output, as in HDCP, which is not high definition copy protection but something else. I just remember it in that way. So that exists already, you know, so there's no reason that you need to encrypt the signal as it's traveling over the air. And encrypting the signal over the air just adds additional costs. It adds a license cost to the decoder and to the broadcaster for that matter. And it also means that there's no standardization. It means that whatever the encryption module that you have has to be in every single device. And that's an issue. You know, you don't want that situation because it stops. It means that you're forced to use a particular solution in order to receive a television signal, and that's not what was envisaged as part of the digital migration. We shouldn't be thinking that in 10 years' time you still need to go out and buy a box in order to get digital TV. You should be able to just buy a television with that stuff built in.
Mm.
But the fact that you're going to use encryption will make that very unlikely.
Yeah. So why has ETV taken such a strong stand on this issue?
What they say or what I think?
No, what's your interpretation of it?
Okay, the only reason that you need encryption is because you want to be able to control the decoder remotely. You want to be able to switch it off or switch it on for particular content. And the only reason that I can see for that is if you're selling that content. Subscription services, pay TV services. That's the reason why you want encryption.
But they have denied flat out that they have any interest in launching a pay television service.
Yeah, I know that's what they've said. But they also originally were opposed to encryption and then changed their minds. So I'm really not sure.
reading back on some old articles, and the former chief operating officer of eMedia, I think it's called eMedia Investments or eMedia Holdings, Bronwyn Keane-Young, also argued that encryption is necessary, because otherwise DSTV can simply take the unencrypted signal and make it available on their platforms free of charge. I'm not sure I buy that argument.
No, they can't. They obviously can't. You can't redistribute something without paying a license for it. I mean, that's like saying that DSTV can go and pull a BBC signal from the UK and just stick it on their channel.
Well, there are the must-carry regulations that ICASA introduced, which requires pay TV operators to carry the public broadcasters' channels.
Yeah, but those are the public broadcasters' channels.
Yeah.
Okay, which are the SABC channels. That's part of their license agreement.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that they are forced to carry ETV. They pay a license to carry ETV as a channel, even though it's a free-to-air channel.
Yeah.
They actually pay for it. I don't think they pay very much, but they pay for it.
And in fact, they've actually taken a whole range of other channels from eMedia now. Yeah. There's a movies channel and two movies channels on DSTV from eMedia.
Well, it's cheap content to an extent for them because they pay a very low license fee for it because they're ad supported, and ETV has already got the license for that content. So, I don't think that she's got an argument in that sense. The only reason for encryption is to be able to control the decoder. And what reason would you need to do that unless you're suddenly going to crack down on TV license holders, which I can't see happening.
Mm. No, that's not going to happen. That's quite clear. But so we've got this set-top box standard that was created by the South African Bureau of Standards, and that mandates that there be HDCP high def copy protection or whatever it is built into that box that's sold in South Africa, that's going to be in the boxes that are subsidized by the government to poorer households. So that copy protection is there. But if there's no encryption on the signal, could you theoretically then just import a box without HDCP built into it and use that box to pirate ETV's content?
No. Well, you could. I mean, yes, you could obviously do it. You could do it even with the, if the signal was encrypted, you could theoretically do it as well. If it's got an HDMI output, the copy protection is part of the HDMI standard.
Yeah.
It's not, you can't separate HDCP from HDMI. It's part of it's baked into the actual standard. So in terms of high definition signal, no, definitely not.
Standard definition, you might be able to do it, but.
Yeah, standard definition, the chances are there'd be some kind of macrovision encoding, which is an analog signal encryption solution. There's a chance that they would include that. But, you know, I don't really think that anybody's going to jump through that many hoops to do it. I mean, it's just not worth the effort.
For standard definition content.
Standard definition content.
Which has probably already been pirated and available on BitTorrent.
Yeah, yeah. And to be honest with you, if you were prepared to jump through a few hoops, you can go and buy a box that will defeat HDCP as well. You know, you'll be able to pirate. If somebody wants to pirate the content as an output from the box, they'll do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible to do it. It's just
there are more efficient ways of doing it if you wanted to do it.
It's just not worth the effort, to be honest.
If you want
to
pirate a movie, go and buy the Blu-ray and rip the Blu-ray, which is very easy to do.
Exactly. So it still doesn't add any real value to the argument for encrypting the signal between the broadcaster and the box itself. Mm.
So the other side of the digital TV mess is the subsidized decoder program. That's also become mired in controversy. I haven't followed it as closely as maybe I should have, but that's also threatening to disrupt the migration process. Was this subsidy idea and this idea to try and create a local electronics manufacturing industry on the back of the migration project a spectacularly bad idea?
I think as a policy it was a bad idea because it wasn't core to what needed to be done. So what needed to be done is, I mean, I think the whole point of this digital migration is everybody seems to have lost, they've lost the target, they've lost what the objective was. The objective was to free up spectrum for other uses.
Broadband mainly.
Yeah, yeah.
Almost exclusively.
Almost exclusively to free up spectrum. You know, the analog TV uses up a huge amount of spectrum very, very badly, inefficiently, and that same amount of information can be sent digitally on a much, much smaller, using much less bandwidth. And I also understand this digital migration is only the first part of the digital migration. There's another part.
Second phase,
which still has to come. It's like we're not going to see that in this century, I don't think.
That's the restacking of spectrum.
Yeah, that's restacking it. So everybody seems to have lost the reason that why we're doing this. And
except for the telecoms operators who are very keenly aware of this.
But well, I think they must find some other solutions because it's not going to get resolved quickly. So part of the problem is that the core idea was to shift the analog stuff into the digital domain to be more efficient and also to open up the spectrum. But as soon as you start adding kind of local production issues and business enablement ideas, and the DTI was involved in terms of creating new entrepreneurs in the electronic space and all that, those things are tangential to what we're trying to achieve. You know, if they'd allowed the market to drive this process, we would have had a digital migration done years before the deadline. It would have been completed. They would have still been able to do some kind of subsidy for the indigent households who wouldn't be able to afford it, and it would have been finished. It would have probably cost less to complete the project than we've already spent on the project after 12 years and no outcome. So yes, I think it was a bad policy to start with. I think that the flaws within that bad policy allowed patronage and corruption to damage it even further. And that's why we are where we are today.
So what do we do now with the set-top box project specifically? Is it possible to scrap it at this point?
I think it needs to be scrapped. I think, to all intents and purposes, it is scrapped in terms of the subsidy program. USASA has already said it's not going to happen. If I were to be honest with you, the other thing that's happened is that technology has overtaken. We don't need digital terrestrial television anymore. You know, in fact, we should rather probably be looking at cancelling the project completely, forgetting about digital terrestrial television, not having it. We don't need it. We can free up some more space in terms of the spectrum and use satellite for those people that require broadcast television.
Because Centec has a satellite up there already, right? I mean, they've leased capacity because they needed to provide coverage in the square kilometer array in the Karoo where they can't put up their towers.
This is exactly my point. So they're already broadcasting over a DVB-S2 satellite.
Yeah. Free Vision, I think it's called.
Yeah, it's the same process that OpenView HD and DSTV are using. They're using the same technology. The costs of distributing satellite decoders and dishes will be no more expensive than distributing DTT decoders and aerials. And we can do it immediately. You know, that's as I say, Centec is already putting that signal up to a satellite to handle the spillover areas from Botswana and Namibia. So we might as well just do it for the whole country. Forget having DTT completely. Free up some more spectrum for the mobile operators.
Yeah.
And forget this whole story about local production and stuff like that. And also we can go away from that encryption story as well, because DVB-S2 has to be encrypted. Because there's a footprint issue, and you need to constrain it within an area. And then there's a good reason to have encryption. So they can have encryption, and the pay TV guys can be quite happy because there is encryption.
Wow, I think we've just solved the whole problem, Andrew. Should we go and make a pitch to the minister?
Yeah. Look, which minister? Because I'm actually not sure who the minister is right now. It's changed so often.
I think it's Mamaloke Kubai.
Okay.
I think. It does change every second week there. But yeah, you make an interesting point. And, you know, there's so much pressure, and not just in South Africa, but internationally, on those sub 1 gigahertz bands. The ITU meets, I think, every 2 years to talk about it. And they're constantly talking about bringing down that IMT or a broadband spectrum lower and lower into the frequencies traditionally used by terrestrial broadcasters. Maybe we could be world pioneers here and simply switch off terrestrial television and let the rest of the world follow us for a change.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have it. So, you know, I know that Centec has spent billions building a DTT network, and successfully, you know, it works.
They've done a great job.
They've done a fantastic job. In fact, I'm thinking back now, 7 years ago, I was testing DTT transmissions from Zentech, and they were working perfectly.
Yeah.
So definitely that's not the issue. I mean, I think Zentech and the SABC, for that matter, have done a fairly good job in terms of doing what they needed to do. The real breakdown has been everything else, the policies, the regulations, the concept of the subsidization of boxes, and the story about local entrepreneurs who are going to start these factories to produce set-top boxes which have a limited shelf life, which we're only going to need for a certain period. It just seems really short-sighted, as though that's suddenly going to create this wonderful utopia of electronics manufacturing in South Africa, which, to be honest, it's not. The market's too small. It's just not justifiable.
Freeing up that spectrum for broadband has a much bigger potential impact on the economy than trying to nurture a small local electronics industry.
I mean, just as an argument, I mean, and this is existing things that we can go out to. So you can go out today and buy an OpenView HD decoder and a dish probably for less than 500 rand.
Yeah, and they've sold 1 million of them now.
Yeah, I've given away 1 million of them, yeah. I don't think they're making any money on OpenView HD, so I'm not sure how long it's going to last. But the point of the matter is that decoder, which as far as I know is locally built, to be honest with you, I think its components are sourced internationally, but it's locally built, has a price tag of around about 300 rand.
Yeah.
And you can get a dish for another 200, 250 rand. That basically is cheaper than the cost that we were seeing for a DTT decoder alone.
Yeah.
We were talking about costs of 700 rand for a DTT decoder, for a product that you can buy for less than $5 from China. It just seems that there's kind of a mismatch of what we need to do and why we're doing it.
Mm. Andrew Fraser is an independent marketing consultant. Is that still how we describe you, Andrew?
Yeah, that'll do.
What's your Twitter handle again if people want to give you a follow?
At Arfness, ARFNESS.
Thank you for talking to Tech Central today. It's been a great discussion.
Thank you very much.